This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey, I'm delighted to introduce my very special guest, Austin Ratner, and he is an author and a scholar. Before pursuing his career as a writer, Austin attended Princeton University and the University of Michigan, and he also received a medical degree from Johns Hopkins University. Although he was trained to be a physician, and I think he was on his way to being a neurologist, he decided to leave the medical field and become a writer. In addition to the book we're going to talk about today, The Psychoanalyst's Aversion to Proof, his earlier books include Concepts of Medical Physiology, The Jump Artist, for which he won the Sammy Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature, and The Land of the Living, which was translated into French. The French version was called The Lost Boy. Austin also taught creative writing at the Sackett Street Writers Workshop for the last 10 years. I could say a lot more, but I think we'll learn about this very interesting man and his book. We'll learn a lot more if I ask him questions about his psychoanalyst aversion to proof, peppered with a few of my observations. So on that note, I'll start with one of my early observations about the book. You know a great deal about psychoanalysis for a non-analyst. Can you say a bit about that?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your podcast, and I'm delighted to be here. So how do I know about psychoanalysis, even though I'm not a psychoanalyst? I came to psychoanalysis really early through my family. My grandmother was a child analyst, and I have had my own personal psychoanalysis. And in addition, before doing an extensive amount of research to write this book, The Psychoanalyst's Aversion to Proof, I did a mentorship through the American Psychoanalytic Association, where I studied some core Freud texts with an analyst at the New York Psychoanalytic Institute. So I had some semi-formal education in psychoanalysis before doing all this research to write this book, which involved reading even more Freud and a lot of other psychoanalysts as well.
Well, that's helpful. I was going to ask you about your fascination for Freud, because it's quite, it's out of the ordinary for somebody who hasn't studied psychoanalysis in depth to be so fascinated with it. And there's a lot of Freud in your book, obviously, but I think you just explained it. So thank you. Okay, I'm going to shift a bit now. to a very important topic, and that is to the idea of childhood being important for later development. Some people don't think it is. Obviously, as a psychoanalyst, I do, but everybody doesn't. So what would you say to a person, with your knowledge of psychoanalysis, what would you say to someone who says, well, I want to change my behavior? Maybe a man, maybe a woman. They may say, my significant other would agree with me. My behavior could really stand to be changed, but I don't really care about the source. I don't really care about understanding issues or why this or that developed.
That's a really interesting question. And I think that probably does reflect the views of some people who are looking for help. You know, when people come to a psychotherapist for help, they're interested in help with the here and now and what they're feeling at the moment. I think that might be a reason that certain kinds of quick fix solutions, I'll call them, you know, might be appealing, because they hold out the promise of, well, let's just deal with what you're feeling, what you're thinking, and what you're doing in the moment, and let's change it, you know. And that sounds that sounds good, but it's unfortunately the human mind is not quite so simple as that. And I think that really it's common sense to know that. I think that most people do appreciate the significance of childhood in their adult lives. I don't think that's a controversial idea anymore. The fact that knowing or reviewing the your childhood experiences could have therapeutic value might be something that's more controversial. But I think to begin with, people already are way ahead of where they were before Freud in appreciating the influence of childhood and the impact of childhood. And I think that I'm not a practicing psychotherapist and you are, so you know better than I from direct clinical experience, but I would say that you don't have to talk to anyone for very long about their feelings, their problems before they mention their family. You know, the family is, and one's feelings about one's primary family members, whether family of origin or family that you've created as an adult, it's pretty central to people's experience. So I think that I don't think that the case is really that hard to make that one's relationship to one's family members and one's growing up is really important to how you feel as an adult. I think that and the last thing I would say about it is that the therapeutic value of thinking about childhood, I think there's a caricature that is out there of psychoanalysis that, oh, you'll lie down on a couch and you'll free associate about your childhood and you won't be talking about your present day problems. And I think that's outdated. I think that that psychoanalysis, while it appreciates the impact of your family background and your childhood in your constitution, your mental constitution, and your psychological constitution, it isn't a modern day psychoanalysis is not it's not a therapy in which one goes cavorting in reveries the whole time, detached from your current problems. I mean, psychoanalysis, I think for many psychoanalysts, the treatment begins with today, and it begins with the problems and the behaviors, just like cognitive behavioral therapy does. It just brings a more in-depth notion of psychological complexity, feelings, where they come from, the roots of those feelings.
So I can see your enthusiasm in your answers.
Yeah.
No matter what the question I ask, when it has to do with psychoanalysis, that's great to see. I would agree that when new patients come in, I tell them about free association. I say, yeah, that's something that you'll do from time to time, but that doesn't mean that if you have a problem with your significant other that you don't come in and talk about it, or your boss, or any other kind of thing. So yeah, I think that's a good, you made a good point there.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to move on just a bit to back to your book. I was very enthused when I read it, because I had written something lately and I thought that we were trying to get something in the public eye. And what I'm trying to get, and have been for a number of years, and after writing several books, is projective identification, which I call it blame shifting, but it's technically a little different. And I think that you're trying to get out there the idea of, well, first of all, how Freud felt about and dealt with criticism. And yeah. So I thought those were similar ideas. As I read it more often, as I've read various parts a number of times, I thought what we were talking about was pretty much the same thing, not even just similar. I think that an aversion to proof, as you've described it, is an illustration of projective identification. For example, I think Freud and others who followed him had to rid themselves of feeling criticized, or they wanted to rid themselves of that. So it obviously, and then put it elsewhere or onto other people. Can you say a bit about Freud's experience of being criticized? Because he researched it so much?
Yes. Freud was very sensitive to criticism. That was true in my research on his life and his letters that he wrote and his career path. He was very sensitive to criticism since long before publishing anything related to psychoanalysis. And I think that it's also a somewhat universal trait to be sensitive to criticism. I don't think he invented it, but I think he had a feeling that he had special capabilities. He wanted to be appreciated and loved. And when he didn't feel that coming his way, sometimes he could be irrationally defensive, I would say. And I could say a lot more about that in terms of how that personality trait, or how that sort of defensive psychology in Freud played out once he was trying to deliver to the world an incredibly controversial body of knowledge and ideas, ideas that would provoke criticism. You know, he was not simply, you know, many other scientists were trying to, they may have encountered criticism, they may have encountered resistance from the outside world to their ambitions, but they weren't necessarily putting forward paradigm shifting, groundbreaking theories that sort of radically revised our notion of human being. And they weren't putting forward ideas that dealt with sex and aggression, and ideas that people make people squeamish to think about. So the particular subject matter that Freud was dealing with was particularly provocative of criticism, and then he was particularly sensitive to it. So it was kind of a recipe for there to be some irrational response to the stress of the situation. And that was what the book really, that was the origin of the book, was really that I felt from reading the introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, reading on the history of the psychoanalytic movement, and reading Freud's letters, you could just see this theme of a defensive, irrational response to criticism. And there's a few anecdotes. I don't know if they're of interest now, but I mean, there's a few anecdotes that I tell about particular moments in the history of psychoanalysis and in the history of Freud's career, where you can really see how he had a distorted view of criticism of him, where he would kind of anticipate it where it wasn't there, or exaggerate it when it came to him. And I think he was projecting some of his own criticism of himself for having the audacity to gaze on the forbidden realms of knowledge that he gazed upon in discovering psychoanalysis.
Good point. That's where I think projective identification comes in, because I think this was projected. I agree with you. And I think there were people who identified with it. But moving on from that point, I could talk about projective identification all day. So I'm not going to do that today. I'll go back to the idea that the aversion to proof is not gone. It's still with us. And the major obstacle I see, and I do think it's a major one, is my longstanding observation that many or most people, including some psychoanalysts, are adverse to conflict. They can't handle criticism even today. So this takes us back to your major point. It existed with Freud. Time has gone by. We hope that some of that has shifted, but I don't know. Maybe not. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. And that's also something that I write about in the book, is that the aversion to proof that Freud felt because he was averse to being criticized. It caused him to avoid proof, because that was getting in the arena and subjecting himself to criticism. And I think that I write about it in the book, that this is not unique to Freud, that it has, I think that later analysts have followed Freud's example, because Freud made it a kind of a policy of the whole analytic movement to say, no, we're not going to prove our case because everyone else is too resistant to listen to us. So we're not going to do that. We're going to know the truth ourselves, and we're going to pass it on in these sort of back channels of from one analyst to the next as new analysts are trained. But we're not going to prove our case except by anecdote or less formal means. And I think later analysts have taken his word as gospel and have followed that approach. And then I also think B, the A was a long time ago, but there was an A. Now I'm on B. There's A. A was that I think they followed Freud's example in avoiding proof. B is that I think that anyone who engages in the business of trying to prove the validity of psychoanalysis's concepts and the efficacy of psychoanalytic therapy encounters their own aversion to proof. I've sometimes asked people to do a thought experiment. Imagine you're standing in front of an audience of people who are, you know, either neutral or hostile towards the idea of psychoanalysis. They're skeptics. And it's your job to explain to them the validity, prove to them in a talk, the validity of the notion that children have sexual feelings, infantile sexuality. Does that make you feel anything? Do you feel stressed? Do you feel avoidant towards that situation? And I would say, of course. I mean, yes, absolutely. So to me, that's a thought experiment that illustrates the universality of the feeling of wanting to avoid proving these sort of controversial, provocative ideas that are, you know, not the only ideas in psychoanalysis, but they're essential to psychoanalysis. And I guess I could leave my answer at that for now.
Okay, so I'm going to go back a little bit just to make sure people understand the concept of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You, of course, understand what aversion to proof means. I do because I've read parts of the book over many, many times. But could you just put that in simple terms, aversion to proof, what you're getting at here when it comes to Freud and criticism?
Yeah. I think Arnie Richards, who invited me to publish this book with him with the IP Books, he actually suggested that title, The Psychoanalyst's Aversion to Proof. I had initially called the idea the psychoanalyst's resistance to the task of proof. But I think both things are pretty say what they mean. I mean, it is a group of defense mechanisms that kind of cause an irrational avoidance of the activity, the normal scientific activity of proving your case to the public and to skeptics. So an example would be when Freud, in the introductory lectures on psychoanalysis, towards the end, he says, colleagues and friends of psychoanalysis have urged me to publish statistics on the efficacy of our treatments, you know, to prove that it works. And he said, no, I won't do it. I don't think that's a good idea. And his reasons are to me totally irrational. And I go in depth describing the different ways that different defense mechanisms, including projection, avoidance, and a certain kind of reversal, where Freud's own inner conflict about the discoveries that he made, and his own pride in the discoveries that he made get turned around on him, and he kind of imagines a tidal wave of hostility coming at him that isn't really there, but that defense, then these defenses interact with each other, his conviction that the world was coming after him for what he had discovered caused him to avoid situations where he could be criticized. And proof is, you know, putting your ideas to the test is inviting criticism by definition. So he didn't want to do it. And I think it was a terrible mistake in terms of the growth of the field. Because today we have a ton of evidence, especially in the 21st century, where neuroscience has validated core psychoanalytic concepts. But going back to, in 1968, Howard Chevron published a study in Science that illustrated the fact of unconscious emotion and thought. And the mainstream psychoanalytic community didn't even bother to use the fact. Because their whole modus operandi was to avoid getting in the ring and proving with experiments and such.
I think that's a very good point. And while I think people have certainly moved on in terms of theory and technique from Freud, I think that the mindset of not getting involved with anything empirical, I think that has continued, because that feels very current to me, mm-hmm. that idea. Except for a few people who aren't afraid to speak when attacks are hurled their way, many psychoanalysts seem to accept their fate of only being able to help a few people in a dying profession. You seem to have a different idea, obviously, from what you've said, about the potential for psychoanalytic theory, technique, but maybe most of all for practice, as well as the possibilities for the future. Could you say a little bit more about that? I know you have talked about it, but maybe a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that question invites a continuation of what I was just saying, that while there are a great many people, current analysts, who are averse to proof and to promotion of the field and pessimistic about the prospects of such work, there are a whole bunch of people that over the last decades have been doing amazing work to validate, to explain, to stand up. I mean, there are countless examples. Just off the top of my head, I mean, Sheldon Solomon, who is an experimental psychologist at Skidmore, has done decades of research validating the sort of Freudian idea that death anxiety about the fact of mortality causes denial. And he's done decades of empirical research that validates it. So, I mean, it's out there. I mean, and neuroscience has provided, indisputable proof of the unconscious. So proof is possible, and standing up for psychoanalysis is possible, but the work of it has to get done. And I don't think we have a choice. I don't think it's a choice to say, well, it's too hard, so I'm not going to do it, because I don't think it's a choice to say, well, I'll help who I can help, but I'm not going to, if psychoanalysis is doomed, then so be it. I don't think that we have the luxury of that choice. And Carl Sagan, the great, public explicator of science and physics, and he said about psychoanalysis that the unconscious irrational emotions may well play a dominant role in international relations. And if we don't understand ourselves, we're doomed as a species. And I really believe that. I mean, there is no choice here. If we're going to carry on as a species, we need this amazing body of work that Freud did, and that later psychoanalysts have continued to build upon and evolve and change. And we need it. We need self-insight to survive. So I think the need is clear, and I am optimistic that it can be done. I think that for me, analyzing my own aversion to the work of doing promotion and proof is helpful to relieving the paralysis that can attach to the activity.
Well, again, I think it's also very important for the survival of all of us. Putting that into action may be a little bit different, but you do have some ideas about that that I want to talk about in a minute or two, or in a few minutes. Sort of on that note, your book seems like it would be a good assigned reading for all serious students of psychoanalytic thinking. And I don't mean just students. I mean people who want to move towards changing things. And I think one of the reasons is because it speaks to the truth about criticism in this field and the anxiety that surrounds it. Do you have more thoughts about that? Because people still, as we've both said, don't want to be criticized, just like Freud. So how do you subject this to scrutiny if people don't want to be criticized? Because when you look at things from an empirical perspective, you're always going to have criticism and critique. So
So I hear in your question, in part, a question about the reception of the book and the reception of these ideas in the psychoanalytic community. And there are those like you who have been really supportive, and I've been really kind of surprised even by the extent of support in some quarters. Equally surprised by the extent of what I would characterize as irrational kind of hostility towards these ideas in other quarters. And I think that this is something that everybody who has a stake in the field and who believes and who understands its importance would benefit from doing a little bit of self-reflection on the emotional difficulties that surround proof and public exposition of psychoanalysis. I like to think that this book also, even though it's looking at psychoanalytic history through a particular lens, it has a lot of psychoanalysis in it. I mean, it has a lot of just, you know, if you're interested in psychoanalysis, it's got a lot. It's got a lot in it. It's got a lot about psychoanalytic history. It's got a lot about theory. It's got a lot about the attempts to validate the research. And so hopefully it is a beneficial book for everyone to read. I think that the fact that people might be critical of the book and they, in my opinion, some of their criticisms are not fair or irrational. What I can do is not let that silence me, and I can sort of walk the walk that I'm talking in this book and just keep doing the work of calling attention to this problem and trying to get people to understand it and understand it in themselves so that they can overcome it.
Well, there certainly is a lot in one book, and it's not super thick, but it's got a lot in it. You're definitely right about that. To shift gears slightly, although this is definitely in the book, and since you've read so much about narcissism, how much of a factor do you think it plays in our ability to see ourselves? Now, that might seem like an obvious answer, but I'll go on a little bit. In other words, you mentioned that Freud talked about his inviolate silence towards others. Do you think he was talking about his wish not to be hated or his desire to be loved? And you've touched on that a little bit, but it's complicated and complex.
Yeah. He would often say it wasn't his job to validate psychoanalysis, others should do it. And I do think that there was some deep wish for to be loved in that, like an emotional, a real emotional, a wish to be loved that had a distorting effect on his proof activities, that he in some ways misunderstood the act of proof as a emotional transaction, as a time when he would either be loved or he would not receive the love that he wanted and deserved. And the interference of emotion in what should be a purely neutral, rational activity of proof and overcoming questions with facts and arguments, emotion could get in the way. On the other hand, Freud was also, as we all know, he was the most rhetorically skilled writer you'll ever read. I mean, he and the introductory lectures, while they contain moments of emotional interference around those pockets of emotional interference, it's the clearest and best exposition of his ideas. I mean, he was good at it, even as he denigrated the introductory lectures as if they weren't a real achievement, as if they weren't as successful as they were. I mean, they were translated into every language around the globe during his lifetime. As a writer, I can tell you that seems very successful to me. And books don't often have that life.
Well, that's a good point. That certainly does describe successful books.
Yeah.
In section 5 of your book, you discuss some ideas about and solutions to the problems associated with proof aversion. For example, the fact that most analysts don't understand what's at stake if this is ignored. I think that's really important. Maybe if the cost of ignoring this topic, if it were known to more people, maybe more people would be likely to get involved. Any thoughts about that?
Well, sometimes, there's two ways of measuring the importance of addressing this. One is the future of the field, and the other is the future of the human race. And, you know, I already commented on that. But in terms of the importance of doing this work of validation to the survival of the field, the pessimism that I've encountered sometimes, I use an analogy to describe what I think about it. The analogy is, I grew up in Shaker Heights, Ohio. Shaker Heights was named after a Protestant sect called the Shakers. They no longer exist. And one of the reasons they no longer exist is because they believed in celibacy so devoutly and were so successful in hewing to that that virtue that they no longer are around. And, I feel like many psychoanalysts want to be so chaste about the dirty work and the hard business of proof that they'll go right on sort of abstaining from that business until they're no longer around. And we can't let that happen.
Well, you're certainly a good person to be among the leaders of this charge, for sure. And on that note, just move slightly to a different topic, related though, but different. We both talk about Trump in our books. And now that he's announced his intention to run in 2024, can you say a little bit about his total disregard for truth and how that's destroying democracy, which is also something that I talk about in my book, which also has as the subtitle, The Projective Identification, Blame Shifting, and the Corruption of Democracy.
Yeah, well, my kids would tell you, don't get him started about Trump, man. He'll never shut up. I mean, we're in very disconcerting times with the whole political movement that carried Trump to the White House. And so much of it, as you said, so much of that political movement is in disregard for reality. I mean, the denial of election results and the denial of reality. Trump is a guy who is a walking case study of Freudian defense mechanisms. And I think it's been really interesting to see how Freudian rhetoric has just percolated right up to into the mainstream national discussion around Trump because of it. I mean, you had Nancy Pelosi talking about Trump's projection. And I think it's just because to explain Trump, and I wrote an op-ed in USA Today a few years ago, or during the Trump presidency. Trump presidency is still a phrase that's hard for me to get out of my mouth because it makes me feel ill. But during the Trump presidency, I published an op-ed saying, you know, we all need to get a little bit more Freudian again, just to explain this guy, just to understand what we're seeing. So absolutely, I think psychoanalysis is a critical antidote to the just unconstrained emotionality of politics right now. I don't know if that answers the question, but
yeah, it does as a starting point anyway. And maybe you can tell your kids that you found the perfect person to talk to Trump about, because I also could go on for hours, and I think have. So and I've written a couple of books about him. So
yeah, I look forward to reading those. Yeah.
Thank you. Maybe we could have that. Well, it wouldn't be a debate. It would be a discussion about him at some point.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving back to the topic of psychoanalysis, I agree with your sense that it is extremely important because it deals with people's feelings. It also focuses on the need people have to be understood. Everybody wants to be heard. Everybody wants to be relevant. As we know from social media, that's a whole other topic, but we know that people have a strong desire to be liked. Just using that word, I mean, people seem to really thrive on or crave getting likes. How many likes did you get? Or how many, even if they don't say it, like a lot of people think it, younger people say it. A lot of people say it. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about that, although I guess maybe you've answered a lot of that. Just the idea of the importance of it. You have spoken about it, but the idea of people wanting to be heard, they might not say it that way, but who doesn't want at least one person in the world to understand them and to hear them?
Yeah, I mean, the amount of people on social media sort of crying out to have an audience for their personal lives, it speaks to the hunger for something that psychoanalysis does provide. Psychoanalysts are good listeners, contrary to the old caricature of a remote, you know, analyst who is just, you know, sitting behind the couch and making notes and never saying anything. I think that many contemporary analysts are great listeners. And, I think, yeah, psychoanalysis is offering something that people are hungry for. And the Psychotherapy Action Network that I'm on the board of, they did some market research that actually said that that showed that people are hungry for what psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic psychology has to offer in that vein. They're hungry for someone to listen and to help them understand themselves, hungry to get to the root cause of things. To go back to one of the first questions that we talked about, you know, yes, on one hand, people want quick fixes, but on the other hand, people know that their own problems are deep and they want a deep solution. And that's what psychoanalytic psychology has to offer.
Absolutely. I really like your idea of your new initiative idea to rebrand psychoanalysis that you've referred to in your book as the endowment. I think it's a great idea. I also think it would take an army of psychoanalytic warriors, so to speak, and researchers who aren't afraid of criticism or conflict. This endowment would also need the right kind of leadership for sure, and it would take a lot of money. How feasible do you think that is as 2022 comes to a close?
Yeah, so in the book, I envisioning certain solutions to the kind of fallen state of the psychoanalytic brand, I guess. I was trying to say that money is important to the solution, that funding additional research, funding PR campaigns to let people know about the facts of what psychoanalysis can do, that it works, that its core principles are valid. All of that costs money to do that work. And so I had envisioned creating an endowment that might be able to underwrite that work. I've gotten involved with the American Psychoanalytic Association, and I'm on the committee for public information, and I'm on the board of the Psychotherapy Action Network. And so my first steps in my own work as an advocate has been to try to link up with others who are already engaged in advocacy and try to be supportive of them and try to work with them. So that's where I am with that. Fundraising is a piece of the work. I'm on the development committee for the Psychotherapy Action Network, and so I've actually gone to bat asking people for money for Cyan, and Cyan has already accomplished some great things in terms of PR for the field of psychoanalytic psychology. So, you know, how feasible is it, this idea of an endowment separate from something new? You know, I think that I'm waiting to see how APSA's efforts go and how the Psychotherapy Action Network's efforts go. And I'm hopeful that new directions at APSA and new organizations like Cyan are going to start to get some traction on this issue. And, you know, I always have quixotic, idealistic projects that I'm engaged with. And if it comes down to my feeling that, you know, some new organization there's a need for it, I'm here to think about it with anybody else who wants to work with me on that.
That's great. That's really great to know. I'm always interested in things like that as well. So good to know. I think we could talk about your new and refreshing and really in-depth, just wonderful ideas about psychoanalysis in a several part series. In what I hope will be part one, do you have any other thoughts that you think are important to add today to part one? I'll be presumptuous. Part one.
No, I'd love to come back and talk with you some more. I think I probably have bloviated enough for today, but I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and the care and attention that you brought to thinking about my work, which, you know, is a passion project, a labor of love, and it was hard, and it continues to be hard and kind of lonely. So it's meaningful to when someone appreciates it, and I really thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. It really is a wonderful book, and I hope many, 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 many people read it. So in closing, I'd like to thank you very much for sharing your wonderful ideas and for writing this truly inspirational book with us. So, or with me, and I hope the assets people who read it. So with that, we stop for today, but hopefully I will see you again soon. Mm-hmm.